You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Facebook's receiving a lot of credit in the media for encouraging Egyptians to stage anti-government protests yesterday, and Twitter has been cited for having helped Tunisians organize to drive their country's longtime dictator from power earlier in this month. But Evgeny Morozov says the Western media have painted too rosy a picture of the role that these internet-based services have played in fighting repressive governments. In his new book, The Net Delusion, Mr. Morozov describes how the internet has fallen short of the West's optimistic expectations of it as a tool for regime change, and explains how several authoritarian governments have even co-opted the internet to undermine dissent. His book is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
You've used a term to describe the willingness of the Western media and the U.S. government to view the internet as a democratizing force. Cyber utopianism. Is that your term?
No, I think this term has been around for a few years before I used it. But I think there is a certain tendency in American government especially to have a very benign view of the role that companies like Facebook or Google or Twitter play in democratizing authoritarian states. And I think we have to be very critical not to give these companies a free pass just because they are playing some role. And I'm not denying that they are playing some role.
Because obviously they played a role in Tunisia and Egypt. And I'm assuming in the light of these recent developments, you would have wanted to have had a chance to at least write another chapter for the book.
Probably not, in part because I never denied that social media can be used for mobilization. I mean, it's a very simple feature of the internet that it reduces costs for collective action. So, of course, people can find each other and organize and mobilize, and all of that is well known. To me, the key question is, are there any other features to the internet that may also strengthen authoritarian regimes outside of this, you know, very narrow focus on, you know, protest movements?
Well, I'm assuming that to some degree this comes from the fact that you're from Belarus. Hasn't the internet been used in Belarus not by citizens to gain freedom, but by the country's authoritarian government to spread propaganda and to track dissidents?
Sure. I mean, the case of Belarus is very interesting because there is no formal internet filtering. The government doesn't ban access to the websites it doesn't like the way the Chinese government does. But on the other hand, they still have a very tight control over the internet by selectively arresting and intimidating bloggers, or by engaging in all sorts of propaganda campaigns online, often outsourcing this capacity to private companies and having actually private new media companies working for profit going and trying to spin the conversations online in order to discredit the bloggers as agents of the West. What happened just last month after the elections in Belarus? We had elections on December 19th, and there were protests on the main public square in Minsk, the capital. Now there are reports that the government is actually asking mobile phone operators for any information about their subscribers who may have been in the square, because it's very easy for a mobile phone company, a mobile phone operator, to locate all of the users geographically. So you can actually go and now arrest retroactively anyone who has shown up in that square.
I'm assuming that's why the subtitle of this book is The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. But you say that you were once a lot more optimistic about the power of the internet to make positive political changes. Did you at one point fall into what you're calling the Twitter revolution trap?
I did. I grew up in Belarus, and I always had this fascination with how the West could actually help in democratizing the country. And in 2005, I joined an NGO, a nonprofit organization that was actually trying to use new media to bring democratic change, not just to Belarus, but also to other countries in the former Soviet Union. Much of it was the help and assistance of American government, various American agencies, and European governments, and actually spent almost 3 years traveling throughout the former Soviet Union, trying to get to know the problems of bloggers and activists, and trying to teach them and train them how to use blogs and social networks. And I just, at some point, 3 years in, I became very disappointed with our achievements, but I also began noticing that the governments were often smarter than us, and they were actually much more sophisticated in their approach. And I also began noticing that the fact that so many of these new media projects were funded by the American government also put a lot of bloggers and new media entrepreneurs at risk, because they were immediately perceived as political projects aiming at regime change, not just creating, you know, blogging or, you know, new media infrastructure.
And that's perfect if you want to say that there's a conspiracy, a Western conspiracy, is trying to undermine all of our political institutions.
Yes, and, you know, the fact that the American government itself
is
involved
plot.
In this creates its own dynamics where, you know, the reactions of authoritarian governments are not just reactions to the power of blogging. They are also reactions to the possibility of Washington using blogging as a means of regime change.
Well, that almost sounds like Cold War rhetoric, but you say defenders of the internet and internet freedom often fall back on Cold War rhetoric when they argue that opening the floodgates of information will challenge authoritarian regimes.
Well, I looked at some of the statements by major American politicians, from senators to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to even many of her predecessors at the State Department, and all of them seem to frame the problem of internet freedom in Cold War terminology.
Including
Clinton,
that speech
Clinton
that Hillary
herself,
Clinton...
herself, yes, her speech in January 2010 spoke of the information curtain. She spoke of the virtual walls replacing the Berlin Wall. She spoke of bloggers as the new dissidents, producing some as that. All of this, I think, is very present in terms of how American politicians think about the problem, how they conceptualize it. And, of course, it also leads them to wrong conclusions and, I think, wrong expectations about what can be achieved with the power of new media.
Is it at all useful, or is it perceived simply as posturing?
I think it's useful in terms of elevating the status of new media and blogging as a problem within an institution like the State Department. But I don't think it's useful because, in general, because it leads to wrong expectations and it leads to wrong policies. I think it's misleading to view bloggers as dissidents, because there are plenty of bloggers in Russia or Iran who are much more conservative than their governments and who are much more aggressive and anti-Western than their leaders. And I think when we do view them as dissidents, we miss this other side, which often is bigger than the liberal, secular, pro-Western blogosphere.
You have to wonder what Germany would have been like if they'd had the internet in 1930. And there were all of those people who were already had already joined the National Socialist Party.
Sure. I mean, Goebbels made great use of the radio. I mean, that we know. So you can only imagine what he'll make off, you know, podcasting.
Evgeny Morozov's book is The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. It is published by Public Affairs. Let's talk about the positive.
Yes.
Many people have pointed out that the situation in Tunisia may very well be unique.
Yes.
You think it is?
Politically, economically, I think it is unique.
In terms of the Twitter revolution?
In terms of Twitter, no. I mean, again, we have seen, even in Egypt, you know, not to even mention Tunisia, even in Egypt, we have seen that Facebook and social networking sites could be used for mobilizing people, 3 years ago. There was, the so-called Facebook revolution in Egypt, 3 years ago. So,
but Mubarak is still in power and not much has changed.
Exactly. So that's why I think when you look at a country like Tunisia, the reason why there was democratic change was not because Facebook offered a superb platform for organizing, which was not available 2 years ago. It was because the army eventually turned against Ben Ali for all the corruption of his family and for all of the excesses of their rule. Right. So, social media, it's useful to have social media on your side, but it's even more useful to have the army on your side.
But also, wasn't there another factor? More people were using Facebook in Tunisia as a percentage of the population than in any other country in Africa.
It definitely helped. Again, I'm not denying the power of Facebook or the power of social media to mobilize. I think the key question here is, what should we expect when we pronounce Tunisia to be a Facebook revolution or a WikiLeaks revolution?
And you're saying that the real issue here is that he lost the loyalty of his own military.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't follow that if another country like Tunisia has as much or as many Facebook users, they should also expect a revolution. It's not driven by the presence of Facebook users. It's driven by other factors. But having so many Facebook users definitely helps.
Well, a very good example is what happened in Iran with the Green Revolution.
Mm-hmm. And I think Iran is actually does show you – sorry, I'm kind of back to my dark side. But it does show you that if the government stays in power, as it did in Iran, it can actually turn to the same social media websites to gather information about protesters and dissidents.
Originally, the Twitter revolution was seen as a positive thing, but then it backfired.
Well, it backfired in the sense that the government went to sites like Flickr and YouTube and began posting videos and photos on its own websites, asking people to identify if they can recognize anyone on those photos, right? And they claim to have arrested 40 people who simply recognized on photos that protesters uploaded to Flickr. Right? So the key question to ask, I think, also is what happens to the government? What happens to the ruler? If Ben Ali falls, clearly Facebook is a boon to a revolution. If Ben Ali in Tunisia doesn't fall and he stays in power, and then he goes and basically collects all of the tweets, all of the Facebook pokes and text phone messages, he's sitting on so much data that can be so useful in a crackdown. And that's something we need to remember as well.
Well, maybe Tunisia is just a unique case. The Iranian government formed a 12-member cybercrime team that was charged with finding anyone who'd published insults and lies on Iranian websites. And as you said, they also published the photographs. And of course, they had the cooperation of people who supported the regime.
Yes.
Because this can work both ways, even in the democratic aspect.
It definitely can. And, I mean, now we see more and more technologies, like technologies for face recognition, for example, which would allow the Iranians to do it even more effectively. You wouldn't need to publish those photos and ask people for help. You would be able just to pick photos from protests and have them compared to the entire universe of photos uploaded to Facebook to identify those people automatically. And this is what terrifies me the most, because all of the software is developed in the West. It is developed by Western universities, and often it's actually funded by the government of China, which gives grants to research universities in America.
Passport screeners began checking people's Facebook accounts for information on who their friends were and mm-hmm. what their activities were.
Yes. I mean, it sounds terrifying, but I think this is something that we should now expect from any police state and from any security service. They will be turning to such sites to identify connections, not just between activists in the country, but also between activists and their supporters in the West.
You write in your book about the message that Jared Cohen, then a 27-year-old member of the State Department's policy planning staff, sent to on Twitter to during the Iranian protests. Will you tell us about that?
Sure. So Twitter, the company, was planning to have maintenance of their site exactly during the protest in Iran. It was on one of the days where the protests were most active. And this official at the State Department contacted the CEO of Twitter, and he basically asked Twitter to delay maintenance. And I think that was probably a good idea, to ask Twitter to delay maintenance. What was not a good idea was to leak this information to the press. Hmm. So this information eventually appeared, I think, on the front page of the New York Times. And this, on the one hand, it did give some great publicity for the Obama administration, because it showed that, they get new media, they understand the power of the internet. On the other hand, every single government that has some issue with America, from Iran to China to even Russia, all of them interpreted that as American intervention in basically virtual space. They thought that America is using Twitter to get people onto the streets, and they saw it as just a color revolution planned virtually.
And that the internet is controlled by the U.S. government.
Yeah. And then it created its own dynamic with this government's wanting to block Twitter and replace them with their own companies, because they no longer trust American companies, as they are perceived as agents of Washington.
And now Jared Cohen is working at Google Ideas, new think tank that Google has put together.
That's correct.
So he has not been punished for any of this.
No, I think, and the State Department still claims it was a very successful outreach. They still claim that it was the right thing to do, which I think is just ridiculous.
My guest is Evgeny Morozov, a contributing editor to Foreign Policy and Boston Review, and a Schwartz Fellow at the New American Foundation. He's also a visiting scholar at Stanford University, and he has written a book called The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. It's published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Evgeny Morozov, who has written for, among other publications, The Economist, Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, The International Herald Tribune, The Boston Globe, Slate, Le Monde, Frankfurter, Allgemeine Zeitung, The San Francisco Chronicle, Prospect, Dissent. Once I started reading them, I had to read them all. It started getting very long. His book, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, is published by Public Affairs. Despite all the negatives we've been talking about, didn't a man named Mark, is it Feifel? P-F-E-I-F-L-E, former yes. Deputy National Security Advisor in the George W. Bush administration, at one point launch a campaign to nominate Twitter for the Nobel Peace Prize? And it was because of the Iranians.
It was because of the Iranians in 2009. It just shows you the kind of hype that dominates a lot of people in Washington who, do view these tools and these new companies as new equivalents of Radio Free Europe and Voice of America. And I think we shouldn't make that mistake.
But often when I talk to people about the future of America, they talk about technology as our savior. And I wonder if this is just another example of a Western longing for a world in which technology is a liberator rather than an oppressor.
Mm-hmm. There is definitely part of this expectation that technology will save us to much of the rhetoric about internet freedom. I think there is also, coming back to sort of the Cold War aspect of this, there is also a wrong, understanding that it was the radio waves and it was the Xerox machines and fax machines smuggled to the Soviet Union that eventually collapsed the Soviet system. And there are a lot of people who think that, it was Ronald Reagan's support of Voice of America that was the driving force in the collapse of the Soviet Union. So a lot of these expectations now are in some sense transposed to the world of new media, with people thinking that, well, if we could do it with the Soviet Union, can't we do it with China and Iran?
Well, people were listening to Voice of America and the Soviet Union for many, many years. They all talked about how much they fell in love with jazz because they listened to Willis Conover, but It didn't lead to the fall of the wall.
That's my impression as well. But there is this tendency, in Washington among many policymakers to claim credit where credit is not due. So they do want to take credit for undermining the Soviet system by supporting all of those technologies.
Well, couldn't al-Qaeda also take credit for using the internet? They've been successful. They've used it as a successful recruiting tool, for example, and they've spread their ideas on the internet.
Sure. Well, of course they do. As I said, the internet does reduce costs for collective action. So any group of people that want to act together, whether it's terrorists or nationalists or religious extremists, can easily take advantage of the internet. And I think the problem with the very concept of internet freedom, as articulated by Hillary Clinton a year ago, is that it's completely tone deaf to the possibility of many of these non-state actors who are not necessarily pro-democratic or pro-Western and using these technologies to maybe even campaign on issues that are completely anti-democratic.
One of the stories you tell here I'd never heard before. You describe how the Vietnamese government was able in 2009 to infiltrate and co-opt the computers of Vietnamese citizens who had protested the construction of a new bauxite mine. The attack on the Vietnamese computers was only discovered by accident by McAfee, a computer security firm, which was investigating another attack on Google.
We are increasingly seeing that governments, in addition to just bluntly filtering and banning access to websites, they do engage in activities like surveillance. And what happened in Vietnam is that the government or someone acting on their behalf managed to penetrate the computers of the Vietnamese dissidents and basically install some software on them that allowed them not only to monitor what these people were downloading and what these people were writing on their computers, it also allowed them to use those computers to launch attacks on other computers, right? So even if they couldn't find anything, on their hard drives, they could still go and accuse them of basically launching cyber attacks on someone else. So in some sense, it's both spying and it's also trying to use those people, in some kind of an operation where they can be accused of being criminals because their computers are launching cyber attacks.
So what is the ultimate effect of that? Dissidents then wind up censoring themselves, don't they?
There is an element of self-censorship at play here, and I think often with things like cyber attacks, they do not aim to shut you down completely. What they aim at is to exert psychological pressure on you, because once you become a target of a cyber attack, you have to explain yourself to your internet hosting company, which doesn't like being a target of cyber attacks. So you run into problems. So in some sense, having a critical view online now turns into something like a pre-existing condition, because you cannot go and easily transfer yourself to another hosting company because they already know that you will attract cyber attacks, right? So there is this new tax on freedom of expression, which many of us have not even predicted in the past, because we thought all it takes is just to pay a hosting bill. And now it turns out you have to be much more proactive and spend much more money on defending yourself and making yourself heard.
Not everyone has a computer, but a lot of people all throughout the world have mobile phones. Mm-hmm. And aren't we starting to see governments track dissidents' movements using information from their mobile phones?
I think the mobile phone is probably the most insecure piece of consumer technology to ever, make it into our pockets. It's traceable simply because it needs to connect to cell phone towers, right? It does need to connect to them, and it makes it possible to actually figure out your exact location very easily. So as I mentioned in the case of Belarus, it allows the government to track down where the dissidents are or who has showed up at the protest. But it may also be used even more aggressively, for example, to see where some protests are moving. I mean, you can actually map them on the map of a city and see, if any of the numbers belonging to dissidents are congregating in certain parts of the city. So you can actually then proactively deploy police and, do whatever you want to stop the protest.
How aware do you think the typical dissident living in a country that has an authoritarian government has that the technology is putting them at risk?
I think a typical dissident is probably well aware of that, in part because there are lots of trainings funded and conducted by the West. I've been doing those trainings myself when I was still working at that NGO. The problem is that the average user is much less aware. And the promise of social media and the promise of technology was that it will help to bridge the gap between, dissidents and the average citizens. And I think the average citizens are completely uninformed about what's happening. They don't know about the risks that Facebook poses to them, that posting photos to Flickr poses to them. They don't know the risks about the mobile phone. So in some sense, the professional dissidents are probably secure, and they can use a lot of tools to stay anonymous. But the average citizen, I think, is extremely insecure, and in some sense, this cancels out the promise of social media.
My guest is Evgeny Morozov, Morozov. His book, The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You note in the book that authorities in Belarus turned off mobile coverage of a public square during the unsuccessful color revolution there in 2006, and then the authorities in Moldova turned off mobile networks in the spring of 2009 in Chisinau, the capital of the country, to prevent a local Twitter revolution. And yesterday, while the protest was going on, Twitter was blocked throughout Egypt.
And I also heard reports that the mobile networks were down as well in some protest areas. Unfortunately, many authoritarian governments have recognized that owning the telecommunications infrastructure is the key to staying in power. So all of them now want to have full control over mobile operators, but also over internet service providers. So immediately, just a week after the protests started in Iran, the besiegers, the Revolutionary Guards, actually bought the leading and the biggest internet service provider in the country, because they know that they want to have a kill switch button. which they can push when, you know, protests begin brewing. So I think this also explains why so many of these governments are reluctant to see so many of the citizens use sites like Facebook or Twitter, because those are American sites. They would rather have those people on local Chinese or Russian or Iranian social networking websites, because it's much easier for them to, you know, push their owners to behave the way the government wants.
For years, we were told that in China, because of the growing economy and contact with the rest of the world, we would see more of a democratization. But that doesn't seem to be working, and partly because China has been so successful in coming up with ways to counter all of that. The China Daily reported that mobile phone companies in Beijing and Shanghai suspended service to cell phone users who sent messages that had certain words in them, words that were deemed illegal or unhealthy.
I think for several decades, there was this expectation among many policymakers in Washington that authoritarian governments would not be able to send to the internet without suffering economically, right? So the dilemma facing any dictator was that you either send to the internet and then suffer the consequences in terms of economic growth, or you let the internet in and then you suffer the consequences of political liberalization. This is something that became known as dictator's dilemma in political science. And I think it's probably a wrong dilemma. It's a false choice. The governments have managed to let the internet in, but what they are doing increasingly is engage in what I call customized censorship. So they managed to separate investment bankers from human rights activists, and they want the investment bankers to have access to any website they need for work, because they contribute to economic growth, and they want human rights activists to have access only to a set of websites pre-approved by the government, you know, the government intranet, if you will, and not the internet. And this is becoming possible in part because of the information that we ourselves disclose to social media websites like Facebook, like LinkedIn, like many other sites, where just by looking at our friends, it's possible to judge where we are and who we are. Right, it's possible, for example, some researchers have found that it's possible just by looking at the person's Facebook friends to predict his or her sexual orientation. It's very easy to predict that if 25 of your friends are investment bankers, you too are an investment banker, right? And if 25 of your friends are dissident bloggers, you are a dissident. And it's looking at these pools of data and then choosing what to censor and not to censor that I think will be the key to the survival of the states. Because, you know, the dilemma that they face is basically how to separate the good guys from the bad guys. And I think they've solved it so far.
Well, although they allow for all the social networking, don't countries like China argue that all of this was invented in the United States? Last year, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences published a study for the Chinese government which warned that social networking sites threaten state security because Western governments are using them to foment instability.
Well,
suggest that they may even have a good argument there from their point of view.
They actually quoted someone who I think was actually Jared Cohen, the official we discussed earlier, in that report. So I think, again, the positions of authoritarian states here are often the reflection and the reaction to the positions of American politicians. So if American politicians openly endorse something like a Twitter revolution in Iran or China or anywhere else, chances are that authoritarian governments will become very suspicious of their sites. Again, no one would go and ban color orange because it was an orange revolution in Ukraine. It's very easy to go and ban Twitter because there was supposedly a Twitter revolution in Iran. And this is something that I think we in the West need to understand, that, you know, the way we choose to frame these issues rhetorically does matter quite a bit.
Google was called gutsy and heroic by Senator John Kerry, and many journalists, when it announced it was pulling out of China because it was fed up with growing censorship demands of the Chinese government. Is there a downside to their pulling out of China?
Was
it heroic?
There is definitely a downside to them pulling out of China because I think they overall, if you compare them to domestic Chinese search engines, they tend to censor less. So, and that was the original logic on which they entered China. They saw that even though they have to censor a little bit, people will still be able to access more information than they can elsewhere. I think this logic hasn't really worked out the way they did Google thought, because by being in China, they became subject to pressure from the Chinese government, and they entered this pact with the devil, if you will, because the Chinese government kept changing the terms of the contract. So, you know, they kept asking more and more from Google to ban YouTube, to remove links to the Google's main site from google.cn. They kept asking more and more as they themselves were experimenting with new means of internet control. And I think at some point when the cyber attacks hit about a year ago, I think Google just realized that it doesn't really make much sense for them strategically to be adjusting themselves so much to the demands of the Chinese.
Even though they're giving up 1.5 billion people as a result.
I mean, they haven't entirely left China. They're still doing a lot of activities there. They're still selling ads. So it's actually very interesting how that helped to boost the publicity for Google. And, you know, just the months after they announced that they're pulling out of China, they posted an announcement saying that they're recruiting, you know, 100 people to their sales office in China. Right. So, again, we have to be very careful not to attribute too much, heroism to their actions.
Are you concerned that the internet will actually draw energy away from the real efforts to secure political change in some parts of the world?
I am extremely concerned about that, because looking at my own country of Belarus, I do see a lot of young people who limit their activism only to the virtual sphere. They participate in all sorts of online petitions. They join all sorts of Facebook groups campaigning for change in the country. But it almost never translates into real-world offline action. And this is what bothers me so much, that there is this growing disconnect between existing political movements who go and protest in the streets, who get beaten up by the police, who go to jail, and all of that is sad and unfortunate, but I think this is necessary for bringing democratic change. So the government may actually be happy to have all of the young people contained in this digital sandbox where, you know, the young people think that they're achieving change while, you know, from the government's perspective, they're not achieving anything.
On the other hand, the rest of the world can learn about what's going on, as we saw in Iran when we got images of people being killed.
Definitely. I mean, there is a way for social media to bring many of these issues to the top of the media agenda. However, you know, on the other hand, if you look at what happened in Tunisia, it took something like 4 weeks to get Tunisia into American papers. Even though there was a lot of activity on Twitter and Facebook, it still took almost a month to get the story anywhere on the front page of the New York Times. It took just 12 months to get, it took just 12 hours to get the story of similar protests in Moldova on the front page of the New York Times. Why? Because back then social media was still a hot subject. You know, in 2009, everyone wanted to write about the story of young people in Moldova carrying mobile phones and campaigning. I mean, by 2011, I think this narrative of a Twitter revolution no longer appeals even to the mainstream media here. So we have to be very careful. I think there is definitely a role for social media to play, but we shouldn't overestimate it.
The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, is Evgeny Morozov's book that's published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.